we can start individually with our individual relationships and how we navigate forgiveness. And I think that's a conception of justice that is maybe not, doesn't have to be administered by the state.
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hi, everyone. It's Stephanie. And that was Ella Nowicki, the featured guest for this month's Glance at Culture. During our conversation, Ms. Nowicki goes into more depth about the concept of justice within an abolitionist framework as she shares about her senior thesis research on artwork within correctional facilities. She gives examples like mural sketches by social realist Ben Shawn for the Rikers Island Penitentiary that were rejected not just by the city, but also by his potential audience due to their direct statements about prison life, and works by Lucien Bloch during the New Deal era when Ben Shawn was working, as well as from the 1970s by Faith Ringgold that were accepted into women's correctional facilities and offered hope to their viewers. The use of painted backgrounds in correctional facilities today is also discussed, and the question of the carceral gaze and how far work by non-incarcerated artists can go with an incarcerated audience. And Ms. Nowicki shares how she has been influenced by American activist Miriam Kaba, whose idea of justice centered on accountability. Ella Nowicki, welcome to Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Stephanie.
Would you start with describing what it was about Ben Shawn's unrealized Rikers Island murals that drew you in?
Yeah, so I'm an undergraduate art history student, and being from the U.S., studying in the U.K., I've kind of made a return to American art. And I was always particularly interested in the New Deal and left the start of the 1930s. So when I was searching for a senior thesis topic, I came across these sketches by Ben Shawn for Rikers Island Penitentiary. And there are two things that really, two kind of central contradictions that drew me to them. One is we historicized New Deal muralism as a kind of democratization and movement of public art, but you have this corresponding boom in the construction of prisons and also in murals in basically the most anti-public space in which incarcerated people are sort of extracted from the public. So there's that tension in terms of the idea of public art. Also the location of Rikers as essentially probably the most notorious American prison, starting in 1935 as a kind of beacon of reform. So I saw a kind of political potential to trace that narrative of how Rikers failed, and potentially also how the kind of failure of Shawn's mural, which was never made and was rejected both by the city and, as I'll discuss, by some incarcerated viewers, how that rejection and failure can kind of be mapped on to the failure of reform in the 20th century, and what that can tell us about kind of a cautionary tale of how to approach the issue of incarceration.
Would you go into that, describing a bit more?
Yeah, so the mural basically was, it was a project by the two American painters, Ben Shawn and Lou Bloch, both born in the 1890s and working in the style that we call social realism. So their work tended to be fairly didactic and figural and depicting workers in social conditions. So while they were working with Diego Rivera as assistants on his New York murals, they worked together and conceived this idea of a mural history of punishment in the US. So the plan was basically they had a 100-foot-long corridor at Rikers Island to work with. And it was a corridor that led to this big common space that was sometimes called the chapel, other times like a common room or an auditorium. And so Shawn's plan was to, on the west wall, depict a program of reform. And so he was working with the New York Commissioner of Corrections, Austin McCormick, who was a big reformer in the 1930s. And his main policies were kind of charted on that wall as the vision of what incarceration, of what reformist prison practices could be. So it started with a portrait of Thomas Mott Osborne, who is a progressive era kind of hero of prison reform, one of McCormick's mentors. And so it's kind of like a branding of this agenda for the city of New York. And it moves on to policies like prisoner self-government. So you have a scene of incarcerated men sitting at a table at a council meeting. You also have like prisoners playing baseball, as well as two classroom scenes, one auto mechanics class and one more academic class. And this was a kind of key policy of McCormick. He was very focused on pedagogy and education. You also have forms of healthy and productive labor. And that was a central debate in like 1920s and 30s prison reform. And finally, you end with proper medical and psychiatric care. So that was sort of the vision of good prisons that would then be contrasted against the opposite wall, the East Wall, which told basically the story of forced labor as well as corporal punishment. So it started with kind of a scene of crowded cells and moved on to a public whipping of a Black man, and then also scenes of kind of forced industrial labor, an extended sequence of chain gang scenes, and then restricted family visits, and finally culminating in this bread line and a homeless figure. So the idea was that trajectory led to recidivism and sort of perpetuated this carceral system. So it was a dualistic vision of the future of prisons in New York State.
The idea for this was never initially run by any of the inmates, correct?
Yeah, so that's actually thinking about how the kernel of this idea started is a very good way into this project. So it came from Block and Shawn as artists. So that means it came not from the state, although they were funded by New York State through a kind of proto-New Deal program. And they were working with this Commissioner of Corrections. So they're on the payroll of basically the city, working on behalf of the state. But they had brought this idea to them. So it was something that they cared about as socially engaged artists. But on the other side, they weren't consulting prisoners in any systematic way. And Shawn and Block also repeatedly said that they were painting for, quote, visiting penologists and students of sociology. So the idea was basically to kind of frame how the next generation of prison officials would view incarceration and try to guide policy that way. So it was very much a didactic mural for non-incarcerated people, and specifically people going into this field of criminology. So quite a specific audience. And it's an interesting question of how seriously to take that statement, because before I get too far ahead of myself, what happens with the mural is that it's rejected by the city of New York, specifically the Municipal Art Commission, on the grounds that it's psychologically unfit for prisoners and also that it's, quote, antisocial propaganda. So basically, Shawn and Block are in this position where they're defending their work. And so maybe they're saying, you know, we didn't intend it for prisoners in the first place as a kind of defensive maneuver, but also it does seem that the focus was more on reformers sort of in their milieu rather than the people that were the subject of the mural.
Then that leads to this survey that's done with the actual audience that really would be living with these murals. Will you describe that?
Yeah, so it's a great point that prisoners would have been living with these murals because this was a space that would have been a hallway that would have been regularly traversed by incarcerated people. So the Municipal Art Commission thinks about that and thinks about, actually, there is this secondary audience beyond just sort of field trips of sociology students. There are prisoners who will be seeing this. And so that's where they come up with this psychologically unfit criticism. So in response to that, Lou Black and Ben Shawn, as well as Commissioner of Corrections Austin McCormick, organized this survey of, we think, around 60 incarcerated men at Blackwell's Island. So that was the prison that Rikers was going to replace. So they went to Blackwell's Island. They had an unknown number of sketches. And they set them up in this classroom and basically asked four questions about how he would feel seeing the murals on prison walls and what other men would think about it, and also what visitors might think. So we have the handwritten, like, short answer responses of 62 incarcerated men who took the survey. And that's where what my project centers on, particularly the kind of contradictions and complexities within them. Because what happens is a lot of people will say the murals are good, or even the murals are fantastic. But the answer to how do you feel about having the murals on prison walls becomes, I don't want to live with them. Although there is this kind of strain that runs throughout the responses of the murals being inappropriate for a prison setting, the responses are fairly heterogeneous, and it's hard to draw like a single conclusion or a single voice out of this group of 62.
Were there certain comments that struck you as especially surprising or interesting?
Yeah, so I did bring some because I think it is important to understand the phrasing and the particular voices. I think, firstly, it's really interesting the range of people who are responding. There's clearly people with very different levels of formal education and also different concerns. So some people will respond particularly to the style. Like, there are two prisoners who seem to, well, there's one man who connects it to Diego Rivera's mural at Rockefeller Center, which is very apt. Like, he really hit the nail on the head because Sean was an assistant on that mural. So there are certainly respondents who are not, you know, separate from the contemporary art scene. The prison and the art world aren't separate realms. But the really interesting responses are those that essentially say that the murals are too graphic and too distressing. So there's one man who writes, quote, frankly, they are too distressing, and we see enough tragedy without them. So that's a very common argument. The other element to that is essentially the idea that prisoners don't want to see the murals, but visitors might. And there's a lot of suspicion and hesitation about why visitors might want to see them. And there's kind of a sense that the pain of incarceration is being made into a spectacle. So there are, I think, five responses that use the phrase either novelty or mere curiosity. So that's interesting because we can imagine that the survey respondents are kind of talking amongst each other and realizing, coming to this consensus that that their experiences lead them to be this kind of imagery in a different way and to not really want to see it every day. So there's one prisoner who really expresses this in a very poignant way. He says, quote, to those who may pass through the assault halls a heartache, but to the casual visitor, they show the wonderful height to which prison welfare has risen. So there's a sense that what Sean has depicted on the West Wall, this vision of reform, is all well and good, but it A, might not match the conditions on the ground. There are a few respondents who say that basically the mural is fine if the conditions match, you know, live up to that standard. But also the idea that, you know, even this vision of reform is not something that you want to be reminded of. And there's a sense that the ideal prison mural would be something pleasant or altruistic. And there's one prisoner who particularly suggests like a mountain scene. So there's a different type of imagery that some of these respondents are looking for.
Do we have any response by Sean? How does he take it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And he takes it very badly. Basically, this is what's really interesting is you have these very socially engaged artists who, I think a lot of art historians who study them are studying them in some ways because we admire their politics. But when they're put in this position of having to realize that, you know, they're depicting this marginalized group of people, they imagine that they're depicting prisoners for their own good. And when incarcerated viewers kind of speak back, they don't know how to respond. And they respond in a pretty hostile way. So at the time, they essentially, Sean and Block type up this report. They only include 40 of the 62 responses. And I'm not quite sure why that is, if maybe it was a different day of the survey. or if it's this sort of methodological issue. But they basically say in the report that prisoners overwhelmingly support the mural. And that's fairly misleading when you look at the individual responses. So I'm not necessarily saying that it's intentional, but there's a kind of miscommunication between the written responses and the final report. But what's really interesting is that in the 1960s, when Sean and Block are doing oral history interviews, they're asked to reflect, and they basically say, Block says that everyone approved except for people who couldn't understand it. So, you know, kind of standard patronizing response. And Sean says that, first of all, people approved because they thought it was expected of them. So he, in that way, kind of invalidates the critical judgments of these respondents. But he also says that, quote, except for the homosexual section, who were very shocked at those murals, they said we should have painted flowers and birds and things like that. So there's some, you know, hostility there. And he clearly doesn't respect that view that a mural should be, you know, idealistic or flowery. He doesn't want that escapist content.
Suffice it to say, there was no reaction by these artists that said, let me try again.
Yes. And one of the reasons is because there wasn't really a bureaucratic process for them to resubmit. That kind of comes with the WPA. And this mural is like right at the outset of these big New Deal mural programs that we know. So there wasn't as much of an option for them to like revise the sketches. And I do think part of it, if we cut them any slack, it should be because the reason they wanted to continue is partly because of their artistic vision, but also because they wanted to stay on the payroll. And they were paid weekly during the Great Depression. So a lot of it, I think, is about sort of rehabilitating and recovering the project and trying to get it started again.
You mentioned in the presentation I saw you give, I think, how the 1935 survey could be useful for art historians. How do you see that?
I think it's so useful because it's, in my experience, it's very rare to have incarcerated people asked questions about art and asked to make aesthetic judgments. And then secondly, to have these written responses instead of just yes or no answers. And we can really see the sort of variety of approaches that they take. So some people, as we've discussed, are responding to the content of the murals. Some people are responding to style, to the idea of realism or modern art. And then some people kind of ignore the questions and write commentaries to an extent on incarceration in general. So there's one man who basically asks, like, can he expect a job when he's released? Are these labor, you know, vocational training programs going to do him any good? And he bypasses the questions. He just writes a letter sort of to the administration. Or there's also a man who discusses, he basically implies that he feels like he's not guilty, that the reason he's at Blackwell's Island is because he was homeless. And we know that this is probably true because Blackwell's Island was a place for people on short sentences, and often it was for vagrancy laws that, you know, punish homelessness. So we can really see in some ways the wider context of these men's lives. And then at the same time, you have that tension of, you know, the fact that the carceral state erases those details as well. So we only have three responses that are signed and the rest are unnamed.
Where were these surveys archived?
There are 22 in the Archives of American Art, and those are the ones that are the original handwritten papers, and they were saved by Sean in his personal material. So those are in the Rikers Island file at the Archives of American Art, and you can find those online as well. So I could provide the link. The sort of main body of responses that were discussed in the press at the time are these 40 responses that got typed up by Sean and Block. And it was a report sent to Audrey McMahon, the College Art Association director. And she was like this big arts administrator in various New Deal projects. So she was kind of on their behalf seeking to reinvigorate that project and hoping to use the survey as as fodder to convince the Art Commission to repeal their decision.
For the ones that were typed up, we don't have any primary resource to confirm that they typed them up accurately.
Yeah, that's correct. So we don't have the actual original responses. And when I gave this presentation originally, I think there was a social scientist in the audience who was like very appalled at the nature of the methodology. We know that there was a psychiatrist or a criminal psychologist, rather, who devised the questions, but we don't really know who the respondents were either, except for that Austin McCormick tells us it's a representative sample. And we don't have any way to check that or to know the racial demographics, which would be particularly interesting. So there are quite a few holes in the survey, not least that the report, they type up the responses, but they also have a kind of chart where they categorize each of the four questions as a yes or no, and then make this big generalization about whether each response is in favor or against the murals. So there's a lot of places for mistranslations, basically.
Other than these resources that we've discussed, were there others that you used that you found helpful that you would recommend if someone wanted to learn more about this topic?
Yeah, so there's an incredible Sean scholar named Diana Linden, who has been very helpful with this project. And she has published a book with Wayne State University Press called Ben Sean's New Deal Murals. And that is built on her dissertation, which includes a chapter about Rikers, and particularly put Sean in the context of the policies that Austin McCormick was interested in and the discourse of liberal prison reform in the 1930s. So that's one of the largest bodies of research on Sean as a New Deal muralist. There's also a great catalog by Harvard Art Museums called Ben Sean's New York. And that has an article by Deborah Martin Cow about Sean's Rikers mural in the context of his life in the 1930s, particularly in 1934, when he was very involved in the Artists Union, which was a fairly militant leftist organization who published the periodical Art Front. And he was also potentially a card-carrying communist, although we're not quite sure, perhaps for a few months in 1934. So that's a great overview of Sean. I would also say that there's some great primary material from Lucienne Block in a book called Art for the Millions by Frances O'Connor. And that's a kind of collection of sort of short reflections from New Deal artists on the programs. And Lucienne Block, who I believe we'll get to, paints a mural for the women's prison in New York. And she has a short essay that kind of chronicles her interactions with some of the prisoners and also how she understood prison murals in contrast to Sean.
I know that she did get input from the women that would be incarcerated in the institution she was doing the mural for. Was there any written documentation of that other than this essay?
There's much less actual documentation of those women's voices compared to the 1935 survey. There are two letters from two women at the House of Detention writing about the mural. Again, those are quoted, though, by Lucienne Block. So we're not quite sure of the context. It does seem, we do know that she tried more actively to engage with these incarcerated women during the painting process, in contrast to Sean, who distributes the survey afterwards. And crucially, there are a few things that Block at least tells us were added at the impetus of these incarcerated women. One is, so essentially this mural is for the women's house of detention, for the rooftop recreation room. And it's 1935, the same date that Sean's mural is rejected. And it depicts a playground with black and white children playing and then surrounded by trees and tenements with the sort of New York City skyline in the background. So it's a fairly idyllic, but also true to daily life in a New York neighborhood. And the whole idea behind this mural, Block's whole approach is seeing it as, excuse me, Block's approach is seeing it as a, quote, healthy tonic. So she really sees it as a way to comfort prisoners and also to rehabilitate them, because a lot of women prisoners in the 1930s were incarcerated for prostitution, public intoxication, and these crimes that were fairly gendered and related to basically contravening the role of mother. And so the idea was, if you retrain and resocialize these women as mothers by having children in a mural, which Block tells us they adopted and named, that that's a kind of a healthy function of public art. So that's a very different approach to Sean, who isn't, as far as we know, who isn't writing about how incarcerated people are supposed to interact with this.
The two letters, do you know if they were written during the process of the mural being created or afterwards? And what the substance of those are?
Yeah, so those two are written afterwards, sort of right when the mural is finished. And they're both, I believe, to friends or family outside, describing sort of how much they like the mural. So they're positive responses that Block chooses to share with us. And they particularly focus on color. So Block was very interested in trying to interrupt the monotony of the tiles and the cinder block in this building. So she wanted a kind of escapist and colorful scene. And then the other letter particularly says that it seems like the figures or the children in the mural will sort of step out into the actual space of the prison. And so it's written about as very lifelike. And that's one of the things that Block saw as the sort of potential for prison art, is she was very careful about lining up the actual brick of the recreation room with the illusionistic brick in the painting. So the idea that you can dissolve the wall in the space of wall confinement was very powerful to her.
That's one of what was going to be three murals in that rec room, is that right?
That's correct. So I'm not entirely sure, but I believe the story is that the weather wasn't right to finish the frescoes in this kind of outdoor space. And she only ended up painting the first one, which is titled Childhood.
Was that one immediately or shortly after being unveiled then covered up?
It was covered up. I forget the year. She did run into some issues with the prison administrator, Ruth Collins, who was the superintendent of the women's house. And she was initially, at least, very against the idea of a sort of modern urban scene. And she felt that, like she described the kids as ragged children, and she objected to this tenement setting for very classed and probably racialized reasons. And she wanted this, like a landscape or something removed from the social conditions of 1930s New York. So she was a little bit at odds with Block, and Block recalls, you know, putting Collins in her place and saying, "I'm not a wallpaper painter." So there's a lot of, you know, Block fashioning herself as a social realist, and we can see this mural as having some social content, because it does present this vision of integrated recreational spaces, which wasn't the case, you know, in many cases in New York in 1935. So there are some like frictions with the prison administrators. And this is also the women's house is where Faith Ringgold will paint for the women's house, her mural, which is currently, which has been transferred to MoMA. And it was on Rikers then, when the women's house was relocated to Rikers. So there are all these transfers of murals and censorship of murals as well, because we know that Ringgold's was also covered up, basically whitewashed by a warden, and they were able to remove the whitewash off the top of it. But in many cases, we don't really know where a lot of these prison murals, especially from the 30s, went, because it's at the discretion of the administrators. There's another muralist at Rikers named Harold Lehman, who successfully got a mural at Rikers a few years after Sean's was rejected. And he went back, I believe, in the 60s and found that they'd rolled it up somewhere and no one, you know, could ever recover it.
What was that piece? Do we know the imagery for it?
Yeah, so that one, there are photos of it that survive. And it was very consciously sort of marketed to the Art Commission when he submitted it as a sort of antithesis of Sean. So in his opening, his thesis statement for the project, he says, you know, murals, it's kind of common knowledge that murals should fit the place that they're in. But in the case of a prison, it's not healthy to depict prison scenes. So it's this argument against Sean. And I think it comes from Harold Lehman being trained by Mexican muralists and being a very leftist and socially engaged painter like Sean. But in this case, he channels that into an image called Man's Daily Bread, which depicts like agricultural labor on the one side and industrial labor on the other. And they sort of meet in the middle in this image of a family around a dinner table reaping the benefits of that labor. So it's a fairly innocuous subject, but it's done in a very dynamic and heroic style. So it fits into this New Deal iconography of labor in the family. And it doesn't ever enter the territory of trying to comment directly on the carceral state, which you know, Lehman saw as kind of Sean's mistake. And I think that there are two reasons that Lehman succeeds where Sean fails. And one is Lehman is working for the WPA and they have a way to get around the Art Commission by making edits and appeals. So the Art Commission is less of a kind of stalwart for them. But more importantly, I think Lehman doesn't ever attempt to be as political as Sean in the same arena.
Did you say we don't know where that mural is today?
Yeah, we believe that it was, so it was painted on canvas, I believe, and then installed in the cafeteria at Rikers. And we don't know where it ended up. It's also interesting that Lehman, like Block, he constructs a kind of similar narrative of him at the scaffold painting and discussing with prisoners around him. And he makes connections between basically the subject matter of his mural, sort of activating memories of prisoners' past lives. So there's like, a Midwestern farm boy he writes about who told him, like, this is how you should paint the tractor and things like that, where he's certainly conceiving of himself as in dialogue with prisoners to some extent, but it's not, collaborative mural in the sense that we would imagine today.
What was the resource that you used or resources to pull from for the information about Lehman?
He has his original thesis that he submitted and some sketches that are in the archives of the Art Commission of New York, which is now called the Public Design Commission. So I requested those scans online, and archives have been very, very helpful in this project. And very supportive. So what's great about 1930s murals is that there is this bureaucratic documentation, and you can basically see, to an extent, which dates he resubmitted and, who were the officials on the committee on the Art Commission and what were they writing about. We can also see that Austin McCormick, who had worked with Sean, was advocating on Lehman's behalf and communicating with the Art Commission to say, basically to say that he could get Lehman to kind of tone it down. And there are letters between McCormick and Lehman, emphasizing that you don't want sort of grotesque depictions of laborers and you don't want the viewer to think that you're making fun of them. So this is a kind of debate that goes on in the context of social realism of, when you're depicting like working class subjects, how to like this sort of debate between idealization and this kind of gritty aesthetic that wasn't necessarily accepted by people who are seeing themselves reflected in those murals. So it's a kind of debate that surfaces in the context of Sean with some of the survey respondents who basically say that the mural is offensive to them, that it feels like these depictions of criminalized individuals are sort of, there's one man who writes that it's throwing up in his face, basically implying that he's guilty, or that prisoners are being kind of caricatured as dumb animals, is the other quote. So there's a lot of well-documented discussion between administrators and artists, and then sometimes with prisoners themselves.
The Faith Ringgold mural that you referenced earlier, would you, since you brought it up, would you give a bit of description about that piece?
The Faith Ringgold mural is titled For the Women's House. Ringgold, like Block, and I believe to a greater degree than Block, did want to collaborate with incarcerated women there. And so the content of the mural is focusing on basically women in various jobs, like a policewoman, there's a bus driver, and various other professional roles in which in the 1970s were, you know, fairly radical. It was a fairly radical image of these women's possible futures. And so there's a huge emphasis on self-worth and hope in her discussions with these incarcerated women. And what's interesting is that she writes basically that she sort of wanted to do something like her, for example, the United States of Attica, which is a map of the United States commenting on, you know, the links between carceral state and slavery and the racism of the prison system. And so that's the sort of context for her engagement with the Women's House. But she also writes that when she actually thought about, you know, these women having to see it every day, she wanted to do something that was less sort of partisan. And she saw it, you know, like Block and unlike Sean, as not a venue for a didactic image.
And the very visceral response when men are moved into that space to see those radical images of women is very interesting. Would you have any points about that you'd want to share?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. That's a great point. I think what's really interesting in these cases is that the survival and the reception of these murals very much depends on these successive generations of administrators and, in the case of Ringgold, of prisoners. And the Women's House murals, both Block's and Ringgold's, are so valuable in many ways because we know, and prison murals in general, we know the gender of the audience in a way that we don't with other forms of public art. So there's definitely a gender divide, for example, between Shauna and Block, or for example, Block and Layman, who are both creating these murals that are seeking to rehabilitate and re-socialize prisoners according to certain role models. For Block, it's the mother. And for Layman, you have this combination of labor and the family. So you had the central scene of a mother and father and child at a dinner table, and the familial role of the New Deal worker citizen. But then you also have this very active, this labor role. And so what Ringgold does is, 40 years later, she returns this labor context to the kind of model of the female prisoner and that identity. And so I think even 40 years on from Block, it was still not, the conditions were still not quite ready to envision that.
One of the sources that you bring up in your presentation deals with prison landscapes, a book that kind of gives an overview of different artists and murals from the more recent past, I think. Would you describe that and the two artists that you highlight?
Yeah, so Prison Landscapes is a 2012 book by Elise Emder, and she's an artist and photographer who started this project based on her own discovery in a family album of an image of her visiting her brother in prison. And the book focuses on this practice of painted backdrops, which are often made by incarcerated artists and officially sanctioned. So the prison will basically ask or sometimes commission an artist to paint basically a backdrop for portrait photography. And this is the small photography studio that prisoners and their visitors can get portraits taken in. So they range from all sorts of basically illusionistic landscapes and sometimes they're indoors. So I highlighted an example by the artist Daryl van Maastricht of a kind of this beautiful interior of a home looking onto a landscape with mountains in the background. And that really sort of highlights all the genres of these backdrops. Some are like architectural, and sometimes they're even fantasy architecture, like medieval castles. Others are very natural forests and waterfalls and beaches. And there are others that are sometimes trying to kind of simulate typical family photographs, like, for example, a cruise or a sunset, like vacation photographs. So there's a huge range and a huge, you know, creativity in terms of all these different locations that are conceived by these incarcerated artists. And what Emdur does is she highlights the sort of two aspects of prison art that these murals, these backdrops incorporate. And one is the actual painting itself. So she photographs some of them essentially without people in the frame, but also the way that they're used in fashioning self-representations when prisoners pay for their portrait to be taken and then send them to loved ones. So she put out a kind of open call, I believe, to various institutions and asked incarcerated people to send her their portraits that they had made. And they include some written responses as well. And what I think is so important about prison backdrops in the context of understanding muralism in general is the way that they are so emphatically escapist. And that's a function that has these radical implications when they're being made by incarcerated people and used to affirm these family relationships and to create images that can in some ways be delinked from that prison context. But also that this kind of idealistic, these beautiful landscapes are in some ways papering over the material and emotional realities of that situation. And so the other artist or the other contributor to that book that I highlight is a man named Antoine Ely, who sent a portrait. And he basically says in his statement that accompanies it that he feels as if the backdrop is essentially pressuring him to be happy in, quote, place where every day is sad. And so there's this realization and this emphasis on the fact that illusionistic surfaces and muralism itself doesn't facilitate the conditions for an actual escape or for actual freedom, that there is a wall behind the backdrop.
With the range of work that we've been discussing of murals by non-incarcerated individuals who do or don't get input from their actual audience or would-be audience, and then murals by those who are incarcerated. Do you have any overarching thoughts that you've taken away about the utility of art in an incarcerated institution?
Yeah, so I think it's necessary to distinguish between muralism and other practices in some ways, because the sort of paradox of muralism, both inside prison walls and in general, is that it's conceived as a very popular art, as something that's democratized and accessible, that impacts everyone. And at the same time, you need so many resources and oftentimes an official sanction to do it. So there's that tension when we speak about prison murals, because even the work by incarcerated artists is often fairly heavily monitored and has to be approved by officials. There's also, they're monitored for like gang colors and things like that. So there's a level of censorship that can go on at that level of muralism. But there are other art practices by incarcerated people that have been charted really extensively by the scholar Nicole Fleetwood, who recently had an exhibition and a book called Marking Time, Art in the Age of Mass Incarceration at MoMA PS1 and published by Harvard University Press. And that book is a really monumental and radical collection of art by incarcerated artists, as well as art from more collaborative ventures and workshops. So not just incarcerated artists, or sorry, non-incarcerated artists entering prison and doing this mural, of their own design, but really working in a more deeply connected way with incarcerated collaborators. So in that context, I think there's a really profound photograph by Sean from one of his research visits at Black Wolf's Island, which was the predecessor to Rikers. So he went to essentially research conditions of an unreformed prison, and he takes a photo of a man sitting on the ground of the prison yard in front of an easel and painting a portrait. And we can barely make out the face of the portrait subject. His hand holding the paintbrush is kind of covering it. But we can see, if you really zoom in, there's a small, like, wallet-sized headshot of a woman whose portrait he's presumably painting. And this is Sean's kind of documentation of a practice that persists to this day, and which Nicole Fleetwood has documented, which portraiture is really vital to these artistic economies in prisons, in which guards and other prisoners might commission or trade things with an artist who's known for portraits. And it's a really valuable example of what Fleetwood calls carceral aesthetics, which is the power of art and creativity in a prison to, first of all, change the aesthetic conditions, to reject the kind of sensory assault that prison imposes, but also to reject an identification, the way in which the carceral state identifies the prisoner as, you know, only related to the carceral state, and to affirm these other relationships to family and to the outside world. So this portrait of maybe a partner or a female relative is really showing the power of art to link outside the prison, but also it's taking place in this prison yard, in which you can see a circle of men standing around this painter and really intently watching what he's doing, also watching Sean with the camera. And so we can see in that circle the kind of horizontal and informal relations between artists and other prisoners, and the way that art is kind of an arena for social relations and a kind of necessary everyday practice. So it's really fascinating to see that kind of daily practice reflected in 1934, and something that has been documented and is continuing to this day.
That leads me to then ask you what you see as the utility of art and why it matters.
I think Sean's mural provides us with a kind of model for understanding how artists have conceived art as a very direct tool and as a didactic tool. So Sean posits this model of, you know, socially engaged art in kind of very literal ways. So he's intending to impact policy. He's intending to basically broadcast this policy agenda within the Department of Corrections. And that's one function of art, but we've seen the kind of manifold contradictions and potential issues with that in terms of how do you isolate that specific audience and how do you avoid imposing on an incarcerated audience these images of violence for the sake of consciousness raising. And so I think there are clear tensions that Sean's project alludes us to, particularly also in his depiction of the scene called Whipping in Delaware, in which a Black prisoner is being whipped, and the way that that was received both on the inside by prisoners who speak of it as depressing or offensive or insensitive, compared to the outside, where it was placed in this context of oftentimes non-Black leftist artists depicting instances of racial violence. And the way that those works were sometimes received, for example, by the Black painter Aaron Douglas, as essentially using Black figures as kind of a political pawn instead of deeply engaging. So I think there are questions there. But I also think we should give Sean a lot of credit for being the first, or one of the first, at least in the context of New Deal muralism, to really deeply engage with the issue of incarceration. So I think the project is in many ways a kind of an example of the aspirations of public art as a social tool. But I think we can also point to perhaps that image of the incarcerated painter as reminding us of limitations in some ways, because you have this this gaze between the painter and his portrait subject, the woman in the photograph, and then these intense focus of the prisoners around him on this art making, but we can still see within the frame in the background the like castellated wall of this basically fortress-like wall of the prison yard. And I think that's an important thing to recognize, is art can only go so far in changing material reality. And this is something that the survey respondents as well, a few of them emphasize the need for, you know, the prison to make these changes that are forecast in the mural, and the potential anger and pain that comes from those promises when they fall short. And we know that they do at Rikers. So the question is kind of how far art can go without policy and politics behind it.
How do you see art historians like yourself focusing on this topic as helping to bring awareness to incarcerated voices and on some level facilitating justice for them?
I think that it's necessary in that sense to engage with those tensions. And I'm not seeking to write off Sean's project as failure or to, I'm rather seeking to, you know, neither idealize it nor reject it, and instead see how these incarcerated responses to the project can help us understand the kind of the gaps in lived experience between non-incarcerated and incarcerated artists, and to understand through those gaps the political conditions in which they're made. So for example, I think we can use that kind of tension to get at the broader the violence going on and account for these respondents' lives. There's one case study that I deal with in which, when we look at the West Wall of Sean's mural and these practices that he conceives as healthy and productive labor, include basically farming, building stone walls, bricklaying, and kind of shoveling earth. And these are tasks that map pretty precisely onto the practices, the tasks at the forced labor camp that existed on Rikers Island before the reformist penitentiary was there. So ironically, you have this prison built by forced labor. And I argue that incarcerated respondents made those links and saw those connections that Sean, as a non-incarcerated artist and as someone who was, you know, fairly on board with McCormick's administration, didn't necessarily see. So I think to account for those voices, we have to consider, we have to reconstruct in some ways the experiences that these men may have had or would have been aware of, and understand how those experiences are often very different from those of the non-incarcerated artists entering these contexts. And at the same time, to remember that these survey respondents and these men at Rikers and Blackwell's are not separate from the New York art scene. We spoke about that Diego Rivera connection. And there's also a sense that artists are, that non-incarcerated artists or sort of more mainstream and recognized artists are coming into contact with the carceral state, particularly through the militant organizing of the artists' union. You have various artists being arrested on picket lines. And you also have, for example, the communist cartoonist Robert Minor incarcerated on Blackwell's. So there are all these connections which remind us that the carceral state is operating inside and outside the prison, but also that, you know, art in the 1930s is encompasses the prison as well. And so as much as these men are being extracted from the public and in many ways erased, this concept of art and responses to art can be a way to recover that, to piece together that picture again. There are some interesting questions about sort of how far non-incarcerated artists can go and what they can do. in terms of addressing these issues and for which audiences they're working. So in my conception, I think that some of the most effective work by non-incarcerated artists that I've seen is in many ways either is often speaking to an audience outside the prison. And I think that's what Sean in many ways was trying to do. And perhaps he didn't realize that, but where his mural is successful is often in the context of publications like Art Front, in which his sketches are reproduced, or exhibitions at the Downtown Gallery, for example. So it does function as a fairly successful consciousness-raising tool for non-incarcerated viewers. And I think we've seen with contemporary artists the way that imaging the prison outside the prison can be a way to bring awareness to that connection between the inside and the outside. So there's, for example, in Marking Time, which was the MoMA exhibition that Nicole Fleetwood organized, that's a context in which both incarcerated and non-incarcerated artists come together and speak to this museum going public that often is unfamiliar with these visual codes. And I did want to point to one artist named Larry Cook, who works with these painted backdrops that we've been talking about, but photographs them in new ways. And so there's a series he does in which the subject of the portrait photo standing in front of this printed backdrop is turned away and kneeling and crouched facing the backdrop instead of the camera. And so I think there are ways to speak about these kind of collaborations between non-incarcerated and incarcerated individuals and the way in which they can reject that visibility that, you know, Sean was trying to make the prison very visible and sometimes violently visible. But there are other forms of understanding it. And what Larry Cook also does is he brings these prison backdrops into urban landscapes and natural landscapes and photographs them totally free from prison walls. And I think he's asking these questions about the interconnectedness of the whole system. And so I think that's in some ways the best way to understand it. On the other side, you also have, there's a very significant project by the nonprofit Groundswell at Rikers, in which they worked with incarcerated youth, high school age youth at Rikers, to essentially do these discussions and brainstorming sessions and take those conversations, give them a visual form, and then have these students paint them with assistance, you know, but not being dictated to by professional artists who are coming from the outside. So I think those forms of collaboration and in many ways dissolving some of those boundaries are successful ways to engage with art as a tool for justice.
Then one final question. How would you define justice?
So this has been the central question in many ways, and I also didn't expect it in some sense as an art historian. But I started this project knowing that I wanted to be critical of the carceral state and knowing that I wanted to find a sort of abolitionist frame. And that's been reinforced with essentially every detail I learn, and particularly the sense that Rikers started in 1935 with so many promises and also so many good intentions. So I think it's important to recognize like the very, the fact that McCormick and Sean were very committed to redefining what incarceration meant, and that the system sort of assimilated their vision into something that perpetuated and served the institution more broadly. So I've been most influenced by the abolitionist organizer and writer Miriam Kaba, who conceives of justice in terms of accountability and defines that in distinction to punishment. Miriam Kaba theorizes these two routes for how we can envision consequences for a crime. The one route is punishment, and it's often serves our emotional satisfaction. We want someone who has harmed to be harmed in turn. The other route is oriented toward prevention instead of this emotional response. And the key there is, in my opinion, that they so rarely overlap. So I believe that if we want justice, we want to go that accountability route. And that involves it involves the idea that you can't force someone to take accountability, that they have to come to the conclusion that it's best for them to take accountability. And in order for that to happen, I think that prison can't be the consequence. I think that, you know, if you want to move forward with your life after committing this harm, that there needs to be some kind of route. And it will certainly look different for different degrees of harm. But basically, the idea is we need to create conditions in which someone can willingly and actively come to the conclusion that what they've done is harmful, and then also actively seek to make amends for that. And I think that's the vision of accountability that I see as justice. And in many ways, that the abolitionist framework is kind of overwhelmingly broad and utopian, I think, to some people. But the flip side of that is that it's very hopeful in the sense that it encompasses so many different forms of social relations.
There will be links in the show notes to some of the resources and artwork referenced by Ms. Nowicki. If you'd like to share your thoughts about this or any of the other podcast episodes, please leave your comments online and tag Warfare of Art and Law Podcast, or you can email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com. Until next time, this is Stephanie Draughty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.